CosmicRadio.tv. This podcast would be nothing without our patrons, so special thanks goes out to them. Want to join their ranks and support independent content? Head to our Patreon at patreon.com/8bitlife. Welcome to the fine edition of my so-called 8-Bit Life. I'm your host, Roberto Vegas. Joining me today, Chris Gettman, or better known in my circle of view as Bass Dude, one of my all-time favorite musicians out there.
Hello, hello.
How's it going, sir?
Going well.
This is funny because, when I look back on certain episodes of the past, I've had certain guests that have become weird musical influences on me. You know, I've had Alexander Brandon on in the past. I've had Raheem Jarbo, better known as Megaran, on here. And Maze Dude, you're definitely one of them, just because I kept thinking in my head, and for those who have no idea why that is the case, to make a long story completely shorter, and we're talking about this pre-show. You've been doing game music for how long now?
Been arranging it since, I believe, 2001 or 2000, somewhere around there.
Because I was trying to think in my head and where it was the first time I had heard you in the first place, because for those who have no idea, Maze Dude for a good chunk of time would put music on this website called OC Remix, sort of this weird place. We talked about this in the past of where people tend to put, and I don't like to call them overclock remixes. I think it's a horrible name for what they are, video game remixes. Like, I think it's such a horrible misnomer, because they're for their own right, they're covers, but they're more or less interpretations, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the overclocked name, as I understand it, was there was the remix, but then there was other stuff, you know? And that was, the remix was just part of this larger overclocked brand, and then everything else kind of fell by the wayside as the remixing became the main feature to go there for, so the name just kind of stuck. But yeah, I mean, when overclocked remix was new, I was one of the first remixers as far as the as it grew back when there was no judges panel, back when there was a smaller community, back when they were actively seeking more music instead of getting bombarded with submissions daily and having to actually go through them. So it was a different time.
I don't even remember. Wow, because I don't think I have been that. Then that was definitely before I got involved in it.
It was orange. The original overclock site was this bright orange, ghastly design that was Well, I said by today's standards.
For me, the earliest version of OC Remix I remember, I think still had, I don't even know if it's his current logo, but still had at least the older looking DJ Pretzel logo, which I don't even, I only remember vague memories of this weird floaty head or something. And I don't remember what it physically looks like. I couldn't describe it to you, but that's the earliest incarnation I remember in my head is that. Because even when I joined, there was still became a listener. There was a judges panel. Like, there's always this sort of curated thing. It was never just everything goes, And I think at one point they even while I was there, they made a rule change where something could happen. We're talking that. But even with that included, I still can't remember what the first song I heard of yours. I can remember, however, my earliest recollection of it, which was off of the Square Dance album. And I was telling you in the pre-show this, but it was specifically your cover of Dancing Calcabrino from Final Fantasy IV. And for those who have no idea what section of the game that is, it's when you fight those weird little marionette doll things.
Yeah, I remember that being very, very conscious choice to make fusion too. Let's do a waltz and it's pretty, but how can we make it weird? And that was the industrial waltz. That was kind of one of my first forays into just trying fusion that I had never heard of before. And I'm still doing that today.
Well, because for me, it was such a that song, because I would not only be, as of late jamming out of my car and that stuff, but I've used it as background music as for D&D campaigns and stuff like that, because I've always it's probably I enjoy Final Fantasy IV and VI and all that kind of stuff. And I enjoy that song specifically. I enjoy that it's actually probably my favorite song from the entire video game before, because I would just it's so weirdly maniacal and weirdly as a boss, as all the boss sequences go, it's one of the few that has its own very unique music that isn't really that big of a boss sequence. It's just sort of this weird thing.
It doesn't feel like a fight music. And man, you're making me want to go listen to it again.
Well, because it's a damn good song. It's just like, and so when it came to that remix, I've always loved it because I realize I'm waxing philosophical, but I don't, you know, when the fuck am I ever going to do this again? It's this sort of weird interpretation of this very waltzy, very stuff, but there's all this like weird digital chaos happening in there. And it was one thing that just caught my ear. It was just like, I love this idea of here is this sort of clean sound, but all this kind of weird digital garbage happening around it. It's like, you know, my head I always imagine just like bombs dropping and exploding in the dance room as all this chaos is just swarming around, even though that's not even the fight sequence of the game at all. But that's what always that song put in my head.
I'll give you a little backstory on that then. I was taking composition class at the SUNY Purchase, which is where I went to school. And I had this mad scientist type composition teacher, you know, the crazy gray hair. He looked like he never slept. And this guy loved SoundForge. And he would just love just making entire compositions in SoundForge, which is weird for me. I just used to make samples and stuff, you know, or did. And, you know, he would show, like, you know, digitally how to use actual, like, synthesis, layering sine waves upon themselves to make eventually what sounds like a trumpet and just crazy stuff where, you know, I had to take a crack at it, not only for class, but, well, it was for class. It was a requirement. But then I tried to actually work it into actual compositions and not just do a theoretical, you know, get the grade, but, you know, what sounds can I make that I can use? So a bunch of those weird FM synthesized raw digital sounds are in that track.
That's cool, because it's funny, because it wouldn't be until like I was like also looking back at emails and seeing other things that kind of led up to, you know, how this became and how everything came. Because even I was looking back at emails and I realized that like the last project I remember E4, and then this is where we're going to, you know, kind of talk more about today and a little bit of sort of backstory. Came from an email back in 2005, specifically from 1UP Studios. They were talking about this album that was originally going to come out for it, but something happened, and it couldn't. And it was called The American Album, and it had, you know, Maze Dude's name attached. I go, oh, well, I know that guy. And I immediately downloaded it and loved it. And personally, you know, you're talking about, like, you know, the kind of Dancing Calcabrina, I think there's even a similar song on there. I think it was Mist from Mist 3, where it's like, I think it's called Exiled Samples, where it sort of has a sort of, you know, a very much, you know, if you ever heard that song in Mist 3, it's I think it's the theme of the villain, but I forget the villain's name in that game. And it has, again, this sort of, you know, very kind of wavy thing, but again, all this sort of digital garbage around it to, you know, to sort of illustrate the madness, you know.
Well, the point of that track was to go incredibly backwards in terms of, you know, the main theme was epic, orchestral, choir, you know, just full on. And, you know, am I going to try and fake that with a computer? No, because that's going to sound horrible. I'm not going to bring the fake choir and fake orchestra. But what if I go the exact opposite and actually go 8-bit or lower? I mean, some of those sounds, they were just imported, literally non-samples shoved into a tracker that gets that, you know, that garbage sound. And then through incredible attention to detail, try and make it sound decent.
And I think that's what I liked about it the most, because, like, for me, I was just starting kind of getting into chiptunes. I was starting to get in this sort of mindset of music, you know, sort of, I guess for lack of better words, lower fidelity, but that's not really the correct term. It's such a hard thing to explain, like, what a chiptunes cover is and all that kind of stuff and everything else.
Yeah,
but it had this like, weird life to it that, and I've heard the original song so many times, and I've heard, you know, Jack Wall's original composition and everything else. It's a great piece of music. But there's something about that version that I'm like, I like this one a lot, because it just seems to have way more chaos to it, whereas the other one just had a lot more like despair. And not in a bad way, but in just like, I've always loved that interpretation, your interpretation of that song, just because it has this weirdly digital chaotic moment that's hard to really emulate, I think.
Well, I think that's why people still gravitate to chiptunes and people still make chiptunes. I mean, you think about it. I mean, the Nintendo era, you know, died out and people have better tools and better materials now, or, you know, file size is no longer an issue, but people still appreciate and compose 8-bit chiptunes with square waves and sine waves. Why? Because there's an appreciation for that attention to detail, where it has to be a good composition. It can't just be based on good samples. You know, I mean, it blows my mind with like the really fancy keyboards today. You click a certain sample, you put your finger down, and you get this entire rushing orchestra, and you're like, you didn't do anything. You just pushed your finger, you know. But with chips, you have to work your butt off to make the details right, the notes right, the effects and everything just perfect for it actually to come across as something that's enjoyable to listen to. And, you know, likewise for Nintendo, I mean, you would have sometimes only a few songs in a soundtrack that you play this game for hours. So not only is it a composition that you can stand, but you can stand on repeat.
Yeah.
So the art form to make music that way is something that is just, you know, I think people still gravitate towards. And that's still kind of why I like tracking and why I got into it, because that started out with four channels, lousy samples. What can you do with these restrictions? And then the restrictions, you know, loosen and they loosen. And, you know, so I mean, my fun little niche today is that I'm bringing high quality samples into a tracker that can handle 64 channels, but you still require the same attention to detail to make it work and sound good. And then I bring in the old garbage sounds, as you put them.
Well, because I don't know what because it's not like, oh, it's not noise. And that's, I think that's what is important. And we'll go into what a tracker is, because I know some people in the chat room, some people who are new to the show, even though we've had other guys who use tracking in the past, like Alexander Brandon, the guy that, you know, worked on some stuff for Unreal and stuff. I talk about tracking, we'll explain kind of what that is in a very quick nutshell. It's basically the best way I'll explain tracked files and what a tracker is. It's basically music composition software that is half music and half code. Like, in other words, you'll see notes and you'll see, like, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, and your typical scales. But it's done in this like weird kind of format. It's not like a piano roll. It's not like a sequencer. It's like, I guess it is like, it's like code and music meshing in this weird form. You know,
I actually have a snapshot I can shoot over.
Yeah, well, we'll put this in the show notes and kind of give it that, because when you see a tracker, and when I say you see a tracker, like if you ever you'll see kind of what it looks like. It's just this, you know, sea of letters and numbers and some hex code, you know, some hexadecimal numbers and just all this like weird stuff. And if you're not used to seeing it, it's like, this is what makes music. And yeah, it is. In fact, it's what typically made a lot of music. And for me, like I got into tracking like years ago as sort of a listener, because I never understood why it sounded better than MIDI until years later that I learned that there's actually sample files within them that make them sound better versus the MIDI sequencer sort of using what chip you had there. But before we kind of, you know, start talking about the newest thing we're talking about, which is actually Maze Music currently has a Kickstarter going on. We'll talk about all that stuff with the Barricade album and American Pixels and everything else like that. We should probably kind of go back in time. We had to set a little bit of a stage.
Sure.
How did you get into music in the first place? I mean, because I know that's always a wide thing, but, you know, especially when it comes to trackers, a lot of people who got into them were also musicians before they started, you know, poking around with this, you know, weird digital thing.
Well, that would take it way back to my childhood. It was kind of a musical family. My father played trombone and some piano, and my mom was a singer. And when it came time for me to pick an instrument, I, like my father, chose trombone, and kind of got into playing everything I could in band. You know, I was a band geek. You know, so band, jazz band, marching band, Dixieland. I did all state and all county orchestras. I even got to tour Europe for 2 weeks as part of a regional honor band. I got pretty darn good at trombone for my age. In parallel, you know, I grew up with video games. When I was 4, the Atari came out, and then 5, there's Nintendo. And then shortly thereafter, you know, as I grew, the consoles grew, the technology grew. And I loved the music in Nintendo, and I would actually bring over my little cassette recorder, put it next to the game, record the music and listen to it elsewhere. Like I would like take it to my room and play Nintendo music while I was reading, you know, the music from Rygar kept me company while I did my homework, you know, that kind of stuff. And so I even got into once I learned how to, you know, understand sheet music, I even doodled some trombone music from games. Like even before the computers were at that level, I was tinkering with arranging game music on paper. I never really got any of it played or recorded, and it was probably pretty terrible, but the interest was there. And so it's just funny looking back and thinking about that. Like I was imagining a brass quintet of Rygar music when I was a kid. So fast forward to the, you know, technology continuing to grow, and come my teens, the BBSs started to pop up. So before AOL, before the internet, before all that stuff, there were local BBSs where you could actually dial in with your modem, provided your parents would be kind enough to let you tie up the phone line for however long you're going to be, because I had to ask permission to use the phone because I would be on it for a while. So go to the local BBS, and you know, there's different little things and games and Doom 2 mods. If anyone remembers those, you could get levels that other people made and all that fun stuff. But there was also a little section for music, and it was tracker files, S3M, back if you go far back to Scream Tracker, exactly. And, you know, this was the big thing about the tracker scene is that, you know, the, like we just talked about with the chips, is that the file still had to be pretty small. I mean, a megabyte file that back then was considered large. So you would find tracker files where it's a full 5-minute song, but down to like 50K. It's 50K worth of compressed samples into a file that you would download and then open with a tracker itself to play it back. And then you could see how it was made with the samples. And like you described, it was coded and everything. So, you know, first it became, ooh, music. I want to listen to this. How do I listen to it? Oh, I have to get a tracker. Oh, what's that? Well, okay, let's get it. Let's open it. And then what the heck am I looking at? Like, how do I play this? F5 to hit play. You know, it was just like, it was a whole new world. And I was a teenager and I had a lot of time on my hands. So I dove in, and it was fun. And I started tinkering with writing my own not long after. And then releasing those in the BBSs and sharing them around. And they weren't very good, but there were still enough people who kind of were enthusiastic about the contributions to this scene that it encouraged me to do more. And then, so in the BBSs, I chose the name Maze Man. Because
okay. I was going to ask you what your first one was. I always ask everybody's who were trackers or who were musicians, especially ones that put online early days, like, what was your first handle? And I think like Alexander's was some weird, like just generic kind of name sounding thing. I was just like, you know, because I wonder, and this is sort of the thing, as you mentioned, like, technology has progressed. A lot of people have realized that they have archives of stuff, and they don't realize they still have archives of the shit. I wonder if there's still some tracker files out there under the name Maze Man.
Well, I doubt it, because the big place where I really started to share them around was on AOL. Yeah, AOL when I was 14, I don't know, somewhere around there. Maze Man was taken. So I had to come up with a nickname to my nickname. My buddy Dan Holden called me Maze Dude. In the BBC world, it was like, well, see you later, Maze Dude, like a nickname to the Maze Man name. And I found out the guy who took the name Maze Man actually designed real life, like, hedge mazes, like actual full life real person you can walk through at mazes. So I was like, you know what? I respect that. You keep the name. I'll go with this new one, Maze Dude, and it stuck, and it's unique, and I'm the only one, and you know, I got MazeDude.com and all those things, and it's stuck, and it's easy to say, it's short, you know. And I still get people who pronounce it Maze Dude. I'm like, how do you get that wrong?
See, I've always pronounced it Maze Dude, and maybe that's because of, like, and it's such a funny thing you mentioned that, because, like, for me, I always saw it as sort of the fan of video games that, like, oh, he took that from Earthbound, from the character that made all the weird, you know, Brick Road stuff, Brick Road Maze Dude, and that kind of bullshit.
No, I used to make mazes. I used to actually draw, like, I was big into puzzles, and I still am. But growing up, you know, I would make word searches, crossword puzzles, and mazes. And I still have this collection of this giant folder full of hand-drawn mazes that I made in grade school that I would make and share and, you know, kind of just have be like a hobby. So I figured a Maze Man, that's kind of a fun little play on that. And, you know, I don't really make them anymore, but I still have them. And I like the name Maze Dude.
No, and you're absolutely right that it's unique, because, like, I like I said, like, been listening to you for a while, so I had never, like, until maybe about, oh, it had to have been early, you know, when the new project was beginning, I don't even think I knew your real name. Like, I didn't know you as Chris in any capacity. Like, I always knew, like, oh, Maze Dude, yeah, I know who Maze Dude is. He makes awesome music. And it never crossed my mind that there was any other name to call you by.
Well, I never did that thing where a lot of people have a handle, then they get bored and they switch to their full name. you know, a lot of the guys in the scene have done that. I never did, you know, just stick with Maze Dude.
Well, because it works. You're absolutely right. It's unique. It's succinct and it is brandable. That's like the really, as weird as it sounds, like it's good to have that kind of branding where you can kind of just say, yeah, Maze Dude is that. Here's MazeDude.com. Here's my Twitter handle at MazeDude. All this stuff kind of works out that you sort of become, you know, the brand becomes that. And even in, because again, if people care enough, they learn the real name, but it doesn't matter because it's music. You know,
well, especially, you know, back when I came up with it, you know, search engines weren't a thing, but now they are. And if you have a handle that's really just a popular name, like, you know, Adam Smith or whatever, you Google that, you're going to find a bunch of them. You Google Maze Dude, you find me. So I am kind of proud that it worked out that way.
Yeah, no, it's so funny to bring up the BBS, because it seems to be like everyone seems to have that weird junction off point in terms of especially getting music. Like, they always, like you mentioned, trackers. Like, for me, I think it was, I didn't do BBS stuff, but it was like the early days of the web. And I can't remember what the first mod site I went to. It'd have to have been, it's hard to think that far back now, because it's like, I think I still have like some of my old tracker files that I listened to. Cause even when I got into it, I was like, Winamp was already a thing. And you start to figure out that a lot of these guys who made, you know, tracker music made a lot of demos, and the demo scene was part of all that mixed in. You know, that kind of stuff. So before we move on to next, we should probably move on now actually to the actual the real thing at hand, because I mentioned it at the top of the show that when I first got back introduced to Maze Dude, who's working on this thing called the American Album, sort of this very much a project. And this is something that I always appreciate about this album, by the way. Very few, people that do video game music or covers or interpretations, however you want to call it, remixes, however you want to call it, rarely pay tribute to American composers. Like, we always pay tribute to, you know, Nobu. We always pay tribute to, you know, Koji Kondo. We always pay tribute to a lot of these Japanese composers, which are great and they're amazing, and I'm never ever going to speak an ill-willed word of any of them. But very few people talk about the American composers. I always enjoyed that about the American album, the first one you made.
Yeah, I mean, that was the hook. I mean, you kind of pitched it exactly as I would, where, you know, I mean, part of it was also when I was on Overclocked and I was kind of thinking about, well, what should I remix next? I would look to see what games hadn't been done, you know? So as remix albums and stuff became a thing, you know, with Project Majestic Mix, Square Dance, and these others you talked about, you know, like, what's already been done? And you look at, you know, the Chrono Trigger, Final Fantasy, Mario, Zelda, all those, and you look at the composers, and it's always, you know, like you said, Koji Kondo, Nobu, and so on. So the American album kind of grew from, well, what hasn't been done? And you start looking at the games and just, you know, other names. And it really became a quest to familiarize myself with, you know, these other American guys. And there were names that I'd seen that kind of caught my eye, like from like LucasArts Adventure Games. I would see Michael Land, Clint Bajacki, and Peter McConnell. The Fat Man, you know, on The Seventh Guest was a big, like, this guy is really good music. Who's this guy? So it became this collection of, you know, American composer names to look for, you know, Alexander Brandon, Jack Wall, Tommy Tallarico, and all these guys. And, you know, it just kind of grew into this project. Let's tribute them. Let's honor them. Let's, you know, let's tackle their best. And was a funny side effect. It wasn't even how I intended it to happen, but I was actually able to get in contact with most of these guys and start a conversation where we would talk about remixing and talk about what they wanted to hear. You know, if I'm going to remix one of your songs, what would you pick? And I got a lot of enthusiasm. I mean, Tommy sent me a bunch of stuff with a very, very keen eye to have Global Gladiators remixed, as well as a couple key tracks from Earthworm Jim. So, you know, so it was kind of like, you know, if I hadn't played the games, well, I still had their blessing as far as, you know, what to look for, what to tackle, and what, you know, what would be something that would make them proud and make them excited. So that just, you know, it grew out of that. And I'm carrying the same thing forward with American Pixels. You know, it's the it's not just about pick the popular tracks, pick the famous games. You know, it's on the composers. I mean, because like we talked about, I mean, it's hard work writing that level of music, that amount, and that caliber that you can hear on repeat over and over. And, you know, just a lot of respect is due to that. And when we did the American album originally, you know, it was new. I mean, it was before Bandcamp. It was before composers had their own pages. It was before Video Games Live. So it really was the first of its kind. And I can't say that's the case anymore. There's been a lot of people who've remixed Jake Kaufman's music. There's a lot of remix albums out there on Bandcamp, you know. So, and Video Games Live is really in the public's eye with a lot of these American composers being featured. But at the time, it was the first of its kind.
Well, I mean, you mentioned that then, but even at that time, I mean, Jake Kaufman was better known as Vert and was still making OC remix stuff, you know. You know, I'm blanking the guy's name that did the work for Super Meat Boy.
Danny Baranowski.
Yeah, Darren Baranowski. And he was doing OC remix stuff at that point in time, too. Like, we're at a point now where a lot of these guys, and this is what I find so fucking amazing, is that we're at a point now where these guys that would be covering, you know, a lot of this video game music are in a position where they're making video game music. Like, I always felt like probably the biggest honor and the biggest weird twist of fate was when Jake Kaufman did the music for the Way Forward version of DuckTales. Just because it was like, that's not so much a video game soundtrack. That's a Jake Kaufman like reinterpretation album of the entire DuckTales soundtrack. And it was this like beautiful thing to hear for me because I know him as who, you know, knowing the history of this guy and how he kind of came to be. Him doing that, so that's something else to note, that we're at that point now where you're like where people are paying tribute to people that were already paying tribute, you know, at that point in time.
Yeah, that's funny.
Well, because it's cool. It's what I always found interesting again with that, because you're absolutely right. It was like American was one of the first for me, because everyone would always, you'd always hear certain, like especially on OC Remix in the early days, you'd always hear certain songs covered. You know, you'd always hear certain ones, like you mentioned Chrono Trigger. You always hear, for example, you know, The Corridor. You'd always hear Lucas Theme. You'd always hear certain songs from certain games, no matter how many times they're due, because everyone wants to make that one because that's the song that they love. That's cool. Nothing wrong with that, but it becomes kind of old really quickly when you start delving into the scene. And like for me, especially when it came to the American album, like I had never really heard anyone do Myst. And Myst was like that game for me that had such an impact on me.
That was an odd one to tackle too. Cause I remember, you know, I actually had that game. I played it. There was some nostalgia there, but, it was a strange, cause there was not as, you know, many melodies to gravitate towards as far as like, you know, here's something you walk away humming, but it was more music that set a tone, set an environment, you know, and had this more of ethereal ambient type feel. So, I mean, it was, you know, you make a decision to remix it, then you look at it and you're like, how am I going to do this? You know, versus some of the more, you know, the themes that you would gravitate to is the most famous. You can quickly come up with, oh, I'll just have a guitar do this and piano do this and whatever. So that was, there were inherent challenges with picking some of those games and stuff that, you know, I'm glad to hear they were appreciated for the hard work.
Especially, it's, because like I can imagine like you, especially after doing that album and then getting in contact with a lot of these composers, like in some capacity, it was just sort of a weird like, wow, I'm finally getting to chat with these guys who have inspired me to become who I am. Like these are the guys that like you mentioned in your early days of recording music to cassette tape and just sort of jamming out to Nintendo stuff. But, you know, I can imagine the same thing happened when, you know, once you gravitate towards PC gaming in some capacity, like for me. When I interviewed Alexander Brandon, it was a lot of things. It was like I had literally been listening to the day before, you know, to the music from Deus Ex and not even thinking about that in my car, just sort of just jamming out to the Hong Kong scene. And I can imagine, especially meeting those guys who are like hearing your work, and not only A, you're going to talk to them, but B, that they're happy you're doing this and saying, here's some more that we'd love to hear you do interpretations of.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the tracks in the new album were based on conversations that happened after the first one, where it was like, you know, hey, if you do this again, here's a track I'd like you to do. And it was, you know, it was 10 years later, some of them are finally coming to light.
So we should probably talk about the new thing, because this is something that I've in a weird way been a part of without remembering that I was a part of it. Because I say that as a joke, because this project began when the beginnings of American Pixels was 2012, if not mistaken, right?
I found records from 2011, actually.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Where it was first being concepted. And, you know, when I did the first American album, I cranked the whole thing out in less than a year. I was thinking it was more like 6 months of, you know, intense writing, because I had a lot of free time on my hands. So I started this one After I'm married, after I have a business that I'm running, and you know, and more responsibilities, more bills, and whatever. And I did something kind of stupid. I built a whole website for a project that wasn't done, and I made the website look pretty. I come up with a style, you know, a visual for this American Pixels idea, this concept, and you know, it was a detailed website with pages for every composer and, you know, a proposed track list, a little box for requests. And I thought this would be fun. People get to see the website as the album's made and they can come check in weekly and see progress and monthly and whatever. Well, lo and behold, life happened. And it took forever for the album to get built because just, you know, a lot of stuff happened. You know, I've been through injuries, surgeries, career shifts, became a father, you know, and that's a whole other thing where free time. Yeah. Not much of it when you got a baby. So you know, so I had this page on that site for pre-orders, and sprinkled over those 5 years I got a number of pre-orders of people who had found it, who had either found a link from something else that I had online or from my Maze Dude music site or whatever, and the pre-orders trickled in, and one of them was from you. And I kept detailed records. If anyone's listening to this and they have pre-ordered, I have your name, I have your address, and I will be checking in with you before shipping anything to make sure you still live there, because not everyone does live in the same place, I have found out. And that's okay. But yeah, so it was weird because, you know, there was a thought of this will be purely electronic. I'll release it for free, and the pre-orders will help kind of keep the project alive and, you know, keep excitement going and stuff. Well, as this thing grew and evolved, it became obvious that I would probably need more funding than that if I really want to do this right. And I really did. I wanted to make it as professional as I could, get it professionally mastered, take it to the studio, have some experts really make it mixed properly. You know, get the CD printed, get the artwork done, all these things that, you know, cost money. So it became this really awkward request where I had to go back to pre-order people who had pre-ordered and say, hey, I know you already saved my money for this, but I have a Kickstarter for it now. Can you maybe put your money there instead? And then I'll refund you your original pledge via, or your original pre-order that you did 4 years ago that you forgot about. you know, you're one of those cases where you got.
Well, I mean, it wasn't even a bad thing, because like I remembered why I pre-ordered, and it was, and this is part of the research of doing an interview. I go back, look at the guests, see what I want to talk about, kind of figure out the plot of the conversation. And during the research, I was looking through all my music when they're Maze Dude, and I remembered as I was looking there that there's these four tracks from this like random sort of short album, you know, where you had a cover, you did an interpretation of the Sander Cohen music from Bioshock, one of my personal favorite recent games, and I love that, you know, we're talking about chiptunes, you know, it's an 8-bit cover of that song, but also another Myst track, this is from Myst 4, which again. Mm-hmm. Love it, and kind of a Commodore 64 sound, and a whole bunch of other things on there as well. I mean, like maybe two other tracks. I'm just sort of going by memory at the top of my head. And I remember that was a part of this, like, hey, I have some new stuff here. By the way, I'm working on this new thing for the, you know, American Pixels. If you want to, you know, if you give this much money, you're pre-order. I go, I have that much money on me. Here you go. I can't wait till new music comes out. Because, you know, at that point, I think I'd already started getting very slowly into the whole Kickstarter thing, and sort of the crowdfunding idea. Or maybe it wasn't. It's such a long time since I thought about it, but I was already in that mindset of like, yeah, I can give money for things I like. And it was such a funny thing to just come back now. And it's like, hey, remember that thing you gave money for?
It's, you know, finally happening. Yeah.
And well, because I'm excited because it's. The American album, like I said, was one of the, like, out of a lot of the remix albums I'd heard, and definitely was my earliest recollection of a complete album sort of thing. I mean, we've now come to the point, like I said, you know, we've come to the weird point where, and I say it's full circle, that the team, and I say team as a collective term, of OC Remix is now making music for real video games. And by real video games, I mean, like, there's an album on there that is the soundtrack for Super Street Fighter 2 HD Remix, you know. Like, yeah. We're at that point now. That like remixers.
I'm on that one too.
Exactly. That's just cool. Like we're at that point now where that's becoming the reality. And it's such a weird thing. And this is why I tend to enjoy talking to musicians who are part of that scene or aware of that scene, because for me as the fan and for me as the guy that's sort of been in there since for the early days, not as early as you per se, but definitely in the early days, that we're coming to that point, and it's always exciting to see new stuff come out of everybody for that.
Yeah, and actually, this reminds me of a conversation I had with Mustin back when I did the first album, and you know, because we were forming the Bad Dudes, and there was the 1UP Studios things, and there was you know, a collective of us that were coming together and putting together, you know, EPs and albums under, you know, a group mentality. So we each bring our own style, our own flair, our own technology, and put together an album that is, you know, cohesive because it's the same theme or the same game, but at the same time, not cohesive because we're all different in terms of our technology, our styles, our you know, even the caliber of, you know, just tools that we have at our disposal. But, you know, they're still fun, but you really got to understand going into it, listening to it, that these are all, they're going to sound different, you know, from track to track. There's going to be differences, and be cool with that. And that's kind of what's, you know, a big part of the Overclocked albums as well, is that there's so many different artists on there. So there's a common thread, but it also differences.
And I mean, you can't out-funk Mustin. Like that's not going to happen. I'm sorry. I love your music, Chris, but you cannot outfunk the Mustin and in any capacity. Sorry, that's just a personal. That's a personal plug for Mustin because I
valid point. Yeah, but to finish the thought. So you know, I was asking him like, well, is it going to be weird that I'm doing an album that's, you know, by myself, and I'm doing all these very different genres from track to track, different games, different eras and stuff. And he said, no, because they're all by you. So even if the genres are completely different, you still track them. You still have your flavor, your style in there. Even if the genres jump crazily from track to track, there will still be a cohesive feel to it. And I'm glad that he said that because it kind of gave me confidence to not, you know, shy from trying different genres all over the place, because it still fit, it still flowed. And the new album has that too, where, you know, I've taken things to a new level where I'm bringing in live performers. And I, you know, if you look at my whole history, I've rarely done a co-op where it's me and another artist. I think there's maybe one on Overclocked and then another one on the Doom 2 album. So I'm really going outside the norm here and bringing on not just guest performers, but some unusual instruments that you don't normally hear, you know, have like a solo, like electric bass, classical flute, trombone. It's not just electric guitar and piano, you know? So that's something else too, where there's going to be some unusual sounds and some unusual fusion, but it's still going to be with this united theme and this united concept that bridges it all together that hopefully will be just as effective.
Well, what's been the biggest challenge then specifically this? I mean, beyond just, has it just been simply by bringing in new instruments, new talent? And the only reason I ask that is because you're mentioning that a lot of this is kind of going outside of your comfort zone, for lack of better words, and in terms of you're trying different things, you're upping the samples, like you're trying to raise money so you can actually, you know, as in your words, do it right, you know, master this, get it, you know, get some studio time, do something to the level that you've always wanted to do. Has that been the biggest challenge, is trying to get to there, or is there something else that's sort of been a hurdle that you didn't know going into what it's going to be?
I would say the biggest hurdle is having started this, having committed to it, and then getting swept up with having very little free time was getting to that place mentally where I have these little pockets of time. I'm like, okay, I feel like making music. So I go down to my computer, and then I have this wall in my head that says, now you have to tap into the place where you're going to write the best music you've ever written. And I don't know why that was such a screw to my mind, because it was just this high pressure where it wasn't fun at a certain point, where it was just this, like it became like work. Like I worked all day, put my kid to bed. I have an hour, I'm exhausted. And now I feel like I'm going back to work. And it's hard and challenging and detailed stuff. You know, there's sheet music I got to put together. There's, you know, just these very complex pieces that composers had requested that I wasn't, you know, ready for, that were just, you know, not a simple sit down and riff off of a short theme, but like 4-minute tracks that are heavily detailed with orchestra that I need to decipher and figure out. And it was, you know, hard. So it was getting past that and finding the joy in it and just having fun creating was hard once you're in the thick of being halfway done. And you love what you've written. You love this first half. You can't wait to show it. And then, you know, you're having these inner dialogues where you're like dialogue, whatever, inner conversations in your head where you're trying to figure out, do I even want to finish this thing? Do I want to just release these tracks for free and be done with it? Or do we really push through and get this thing done right? You know, and so it was just this pressure where, you know, it wasn't sit down and write whatever the heck I want. It was sit down and, hey, you have 8 tracks that you've promised that you would finish that you've started. And man, you know, so getting through that was tough. The trick actually that got me on the other side of that recently was actually completely redoing my downstairs, because I had kind of a basement office, home office, and I ran my own business for a while, and it felt like an office. You know, I had the whiteboards, the bulletin boards, the, you know, the schedules, the calendars, all that stuff. And I since 3 years ago shifted to where I'm actually working for a corporation now, and I'm doing websites for a company, and I'm not running the home business anymore. So I would work all day in downtown Syracuse, drive home, and then go back to my office, and it would just suck the energy out of me, feeling like I'm back in the office, surrounded by whiteboards again. So we actually recently converted the whole thing to a man cave, where I tore down the whiteboards, got rid of the bulletin boards, hung up album art, hung up personal weird random crap, souvenirs from my travels. And I brought down some retro games, you know, I got an old TV in the corner, just made it me, just made it like, who cares? This is where I'm going to spend my time. And making that change made me want to be here. I'd be excited to get down here, excited to get back to it. And that really fueled and invigorated me to kind of get back into it. And that was earlier this year. And that's kind of when I really put a hard deadline on myself that, you know, hey, July 4th is coming up in a few months. That's the perfect date to launch the Kickstarter, make it happen. And that fueled me to do a lot of the pre-Kickstarter stuff I had to get done in terms of do the budgeting, do the math, do the numbers, find an actual studio that can professionally master this, meet them, try them out. I actually took a Tyrion remix. It's funny that you mentioned Alexander Brannon. I arranged a track from his Tyrion soundtrack for the album, and it actually came out too heavy. I guess you could say a little too dark and heavy for the full album, but I thought this would make a great bonus track. Hey, how about I use this track with the studio and see if they master it, if I like them, if it's a good fit. So I did that. I took it there in layers, and not only were they great and they could handle my you know, the source files and all the technical stuff, but they also really enjoyed it because it sounded so different. So I got that peace of mind that the album's in good hands. So it's just, you know, but it's still that costs money, and it took some time and research and coordinating and all that stuff. So I've been frantically doing all the pre-Kickstarter stuff, getting the video made, coming up with the script, really just, and also, you know, you said you've, you know, been following the Kickstarter thing. There's been a lot of campaigns by other people in the community, you know, Kunal Majmudar and his Pixel Noir campaign. I mean, he had to run that campaign twice for it to work, and he learned a lot in the process. You know, the Seventh Guest 3 tried to do a Kickstarter and it didn't go great. And then you see Big Giant Circles do a Kickstarter that blows it out of the water. But then you realize he had to spend most of that money on international shipping. So there's a lot, you know, that I had to learn, and I wanted to do it right. So, you know, I got these guys on the phone, I talked to them, I traded stories and talked about what I had planned, and just, you know, pushed. And July 4th it launched, and we're in week 3 now, I think. And, we're over halfway there. And I went off on a tangent. What was the question?
Sorry. I'm here. Like, it's funny. I'm only laughing not because of tangent. I'm laughing because, like, I'm so enthralled. I'm like, no, keep talking. No, you keep going. Yeah. Big giant circles. Totally. I'd love to hear conversations. I know the guys in Dallas and, like, you know, a hop, skip and a jump away from me here in Austin, but you keep talking. Do not. Like, it was such, I'm only laughing not because of anything bad, but more of it, like, I'm sorry, what were we talking about? It's just like, because but that's absolutely right. I'm glad that you're thinking that as a guy doing a Kickstarter, because a lot of people go into these projects not quite sure of what is going to happen or how they're going to get there.
Also, it was, you know, per your point, you pre-order something and then forgot about it. Well, you know, I feel that happened with a lot of people, where they probably started to shrug this album off, like, you know, like, oh yeah, Maze Dude's talking about American Pixels. He's been talking about that for 5 years. I don't care anymore. Well, I figured if I do a Kickstarter and really just get passionate about it again, and it also helped me actually rediscover the passion behind why I started this in the first place, you know, and just kind of remind people that, hey, this thing exists, it's happening, it's getting done, and we're doing it right. And this is your chance to get on board and help and, you know, make it happen. And, you know, and also just really think, you know, what can I do to give back? What other rewards can I give? You know, and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, so it's been a journey to get here, but one way or another, this album's getting done. And, you know, if the Kickstarter fails, can I fund it myself? Yeah, I could, but it would take a lot longer. And I just want to get this thing done. I actually have other projects on the brain that I want to get to and could get on the other side of this. So,
yeah, you know, I think sometimes that's the hardest thing as a creative is that you have you're at this point of you know, especially with this one we talked about, you know, the earliest recollection is 2011 for me, is 2012, and you know, we're in 2016, so who, you know, everything floats. But you bring up the idea of like you have other ideas in your head, and you're just like, I want to work on this new thing, but I still have this old thing that I promised everybody. You know, that I've worked on, and that people have now, and especially, you know, in my case, and while I don't care, because in terms of like, I forgot about it, being like, oh, okay, cool. I don't even expect, like a lot of times, especially when I pre-order something or give money to a Kickstarter, my mentality is it goes like this. And a lot of people think of like Kickstarter as a pre-order thing, which I don't. I always believe it as a, am I comfortable with this money going bye-bye? Because the project may not come out, and that's totally fine. Things happen, whatever. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is too, do I want this thing to happen? Is it something that I believe is a good idea, or that I believe is cool, or something about it? Because I, you know, you talked about Big Giant Circle's recent one, and I gave money to that right away because, you know, Imposter Nostalgia and everything else Big Giant Circle's done in the past, I loved. And so this was just like, hey, yeah, totally. Here's money. I'd love to. I want to hear this new album. How you know, here's more money. And what's funny, you bring up your Kickstarter. And we talked about the original amount of money I gave. I have pledged more than I originally had pre-ordered. If just because the tier was like, well, yeah, I'd love to have all of Maze Dude's music again. I don't know if I have it all. Here's money. I'll take three, you know? And I think that's what's coming. What we're at now, especially with Kickstarter, like a lot of that stuff becomes easier to manage. Like you know, you're one of the few guys I've heard that has done something sort of like their own thing and kept detailed records about who owed money. Cause I was like, when I got the email, I was like, oh shit, I did give money for that. And I was more surprised that you had like records showing all that information.
Well, you know, I want to be honorable to the people who help support instead of just shrug it off. Like, yeah, thanks. Bye. You know, but it's like, no, you believed in this back when it was a list of ideas on a webpage where there was nothing to hear, nothing to preview. And, you know, and I appreciate that. And, I want to thank you for it, but you know, awkwardly at the same time, here's a Kickstarter. Can you go pledge? So it's been weird, actually. A lot of folks, actually, like yourself, have been very cool about going back and chipping in more, which I tremendously appreciate. And there's a bunch of pre-order that I didn't hear back from at all, so I don't know what happened to them. But regardless, you know, I want to make sure even the pre-orders get the full copy of the MP3s or the CD, whatever they asked for back then. Even if they never even go to the Kickstarter because they pre-ordered. So that's done. You know, but it does make it weird when you look at this chunk of funds that came in via pre-orders that are not counted in the pledges. And you're like, but I need to make this minimum.
Yeah, again,
it's been interesting to try to reconcile all that.
Well, because I don't even remember when. I mean, Kickstarter had to be around back in 2012, just based on thoughts in my head. I don't think crowdfunding was where it was back then. I don't think. It's been such a long time.
No, plus, I didn't want to do a Kickstarter to raise money to write the music. I mean,
right.
It's you know, I mean, that's just uncool. I mean, you want to come out and like Zircon did. He said, the music's done. This funding that I'm doing is to get the album, you know, finished as far as, you know, the logistics of getting the mastering, the printing, the CDs, the duplication, all that stuff. So that's, you know, you respect that. And it's like, here's a bunch of it you can listen to. And actually, I don't know if everyone knows this, but I've been releasing more track teasers regularly throughout the month. And I actually have another one that might go up tonight, showcasing some more of the Diablo remix.
Don't tempt me with some Blizzard awesomeness. Don't tempt me with that.
Stay tuned. Well, it was actually Jason Napolitano's idea that I honor Matt Uhlman when we were talking about the album years ago at one of the Magfests. And I wasn't really familiar with his music or that classic Tristram theme at the time, but checked it out, loved it, and now it's a weird chip slash rock fusion with Elshon on lead, so it's pretty darn cool.
Well, because it's funny you bring up Diablo, like that's like Tristram as a song, like is so embedded in my head that I think it went when I forget what the game that the team that made Diablo 1 moved on to. I think it was Torchlight. I think they hired either the guy that composed the music for Diablo or somebody similar. And you hear the music from Torchlight, I go, that sounds striking. I mean, it's different, but it's like the same exact style as that Tristram guitar and that specific composition. It's such a monumental thing in my head that anytime I hear kind of that style of guitar. And I've heard that style of guitar in different composers doing different things. My head always goes, this would be perfect in Diablo. This reminds me of Tristram in so many ways. And it became such a embedded in my mind that, you know, that entire song. So I'm excited for that now.
Yeah. So I mean, I've been trying to, you know, just give back as much as I can, as far as like, here's as much as I can show. And, you know, there's a, you know, there's still mastering and stuff to be done. There's still live instruments to integrate with the electronics. So I don't have full tracks I can really share, many of them, but, you know, I'm trying to give back what I can and just, you know, stay tuned to the social media. There's going to be more coming and, you know, just try to give back as much as I can to, you know, everyone who's been following this, supporting it and sharing it and all that stuff. So, if you haven't seen it yet, go to Kickstarter and click that little updates tab. There's a bunch of links in there to stories. And it's funny that you mentioned like a track, and I can just start talking about it because I really do believe firmly every track has a story. Every track has some genesis, and it's not just a, hey, this will be fun, but there's some homage, there's some obscure tracker that I want to respect by using his sounds and this remix of this theme, which I first learned from this game, from this party, you know. So there's this, you know, the nostalgia is one of the big pieces of why remixing caught on in the first place, right? So it's just fun to have layers of nostalgia, not only in the game, but also in the composer, in the style, in the sounds, in the genre, in the guest performer. I mean, I'm bringing on buddies of mine from college that I haven't talked to in, you know, 10 years, where, you know, it's like, hey, it's me. You want to be a guest artist on this track? And it was just kind of like, oh, hey, you're still doing this stuff, huh? Yep, I am. You're still playing your instrument? Good. So it's been, you know, fun on multiple levels for all those reasons.
Yeah, I was reminded, as you're mentioning the whole like story, I think it was an Inverse Phase did a either a Kickstarter or pre-order, I can't remember, which for, he did a tribute to the first Nine Inch Nails album, and he did it in electric style, and within the manual itself has all like explanation of what these chips are, you know, what system they're in, and then the explanation of the track and all that kind of stuff. So it was, because I did remember, like, especially when it came to the American album, that there was a lot of like bios on each one of them. It might have been American Pixel Reddit too, where like I think it was, maybe it was like the guy that composed Myst, like the Exile sample. I think he like Jack Wall, I think you had had some type of conversation with him at one point. It's such a long time ago, they just sort of have recollections. I don't even know the information's still up there anymore. But that he talked about that track with you and that he enjoyed the hell out of it or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually it's funny. The Advent Rising remix, which has made it to American Pixels, was first requested by Tommy when I was visiting him in his house shortly after the first album. He was showing me a work in progress with synth samples of this theme for this new game that he was very proud of and working on. And he even sent me like the rough draft, an early MP3 format. And it was kind of like, you know, I'd love to hear this remix sometime. And the thing was too, back then I tried and I couldn't get it to click. Like I tried this style, that style, none of it worked. And, it was coming back to this album. And I was like, well, let me try that again. And, you know, and then it finally worked.
I'm just laughing. Just the idea of like, yeah, I was talking with Tommy Tallarico, just like that becomes such commonplace now that in your world, and in a good way. And they like, yeah, I was at Tommy's house and we're talking about music and composing, working, you know, video game music he's making now. That like blows my mind as a fan and as a guy that knows now the history of you and how you got into all this and such. I do want to ask one last question before we close, because we're almost out of time here. And this is something that I was thinking of, especially when it came to, there's a recent Kickstarter that happened for speak of OC Remix on Final Fantasy VI and VII music. I think it was actually Final Fantasy VI specifically, where they had some issues with Square and licensing, and they had to sort of relaunch the Kickstarter and whatnot. How have you gone about that? Have you even remotely sort of got? I mean, it sounds like you've got permission from the artist, so you might be A-OK fine.
Are you asking about the licensing?
Yeah, I'm just curious. Because again, and the only reason I bring it up isn't because of I don't think anything's on the clear on the up and up. It's just because as we've come now to the idea of Kickstarter, we've come now to the idea of remix albums becoming a thing, which is awesome. People like Square have sort of, you know, other video game companies have kind of said, hey, hold on a second, you know, in some form or fashion, even though all this is legal and all this is on the up and up, you know, if we start going through all the fair use and even the more fun things of you know, mechanical licenses and all that crap.
I have some friends at Louder who are helping me with the licensing process. And the thing is, a lot of these games actually had a soundtrack released. So there's an actual like UPC code where you can do the mechanical license, and that's not a problem at all. The tricky ones are for the older games where there was no CD attached, and the companies that built the game are kind of defunct. Like, you know, you look at Maniac Mansion by Jellico. No one knows what Jellico is anymore. You know, so that is going to be a case where I'm going to let them do their job to do what they can to get the license. And if they can't get a hold of the game, they can at least legally put in place what's called a notice of intent, saying, you know, I've legally made the effort to get licensed, yeah, get licensing for this game. And if it doesn't go through, well, I have the legal thing showing that when it does, you're owed your money. If it doesn't, well, we tried and everything's on the up and up. So
that's good, because Louder is a really good service for that sort of stuff. And I'm glad you brought them up, because I've heard they're one of the few ones that I know of that does a really decent job of trying their best to get all the licenses. And you're absolutely right. Like video game music becomes such a very weird thing to license, because, you know, like who's Bun Bun, you know, from the Mega Man soundtrack. And,
yeah,
and you know, how does one license a song from Capcom? You know, where do you go? You know, just if you think of all that crap, you know, and that kind of thing.
But a fun side effect, they can also help through their channels to get this on iTunes and Amazon, which was also on my list. So I'm very happy moving forward with them.
So here's the last thing. And this is the last question, because we are at the hour mark, and I've taken up a lot of more of your time than I seem worthy in the end of it all. What's after that? Well, like let's say American Pixels gets funded, everything goes happy, and all things are great, just because it makes more happy story. What's next? I know every interviewer asks this, but me as a fan, I wonder.
Well, I do have composers that I wanted to fit into American Pixels that I ran out of room. And some of them, I even have some really cool tracks started that I got stuck on. I have an awesome Clive Barker's Jericho remix honoring Chris Velasco, for example. I have some Shantae music that I started for honoring Jake that I got stuck on. So I'd like to finish those and just kind of continually release stuff for free. You know, I feel like the free releases for me have been very sporadic since I started this album. And there's probably a lot of fans who, you know, miss seeing more Maze Dude stuff show up on Overclocked and for free here and there. So I'm going to kind of just get back into that and make a lot of music that I'm not going to care as much about making it like the best I've ever made or requiring live instruments. I'm just going to get back to fun and make some more silly stuff and just get that out. So, you know, I want to keep the project alive in a sense. I want to get back to just writing some other fun stuff that's been on my bucket list. But, you know, I do have some other projects that I kind of want to finish. I have some sheet music for string quartets. Actually, I have a lot of the Double Dragon music arranged for string quartet that I arranged in college, and it never got recorded properly. And Stephen Kennedy, back when we did Project Majestic Mix, also wanted to do an acoustic album. And I wrote a couple tracks for that. I wrote Ninja Gaiden 2 music for string quartet. And I also did a tango from Mega Man 1, the Fireman theme. So I have a variety of stuff that exists on paper that has never been recorded or even played in some cases that I'd love to get that done. So I don't know if that facilitates another Kickstarter or what, but there's definitely no shortage of ideas. You know, otherwise, I do have some non-game stuff I want to do. Actually, I got a buddy who is a phenomenal singer, and we want to do some Christian music, actually. I want to make some Christian electronica, which is not something you really hear. Like, you kind of hear pop, contemporary, but this guy is on board to lend his voice to some really funky, awesome electric stuff that I've never heard either. So that's kind of a fusion I have in mind there. That's kind of a whole different audience in a different world. So that's something else that's kind of on the brain and on the heart to do. So yeah, there's no shortage of ideas and projects and albums. So
that is both encouraging, awesome, and amazing. Chris, thank you so much for being on the show. Tell people where, okay, obviously you have a lot of plugs to go through. So tell people where they can not only A, find your music, but let's say they want to now help the American Pixel become a reality, much like I want it to become a reality. Where can they go?
Through August 4th, I have a redirect in place. So if you go to AmericanPixels.com, that'll take you straight to the Kickstarter campaign. If you're on the campaign and you click updates, there are links to landing pages for specific tracks on there. If you want to hear if you want to read the stories behind them or hear longer previews. Otherwise, if you do scroll through the Kickstarter campaign itself, there are a lot of previews in there. There is an entire free remix, the one we talked about from Tyrion. There's, I believe, links on there as well to my Bandcamp page and stuff. You can find me pretty easily on Facebook and Twitter. The name's Maze Dude. And I'll be sharing more stuff there. And if you go to ocremix.org, obviously I got a lot of music there as well. Also, keep an eye out for music from the Bad Dudes, because I have a new track on the Earthbound album that is freaking awesome.
Yeah, but, I think I'm getting that because I had kicked into the You Are Now Earthbound, which makes me now even more excited to know that you're on that as well.
Yeah, my track on that is actually a violin solo fused with Indonesian gamelan fused with electronics.
Okay. Don't give me any more information beyond that, because because I've only heard the samples that were on the Kickstarter, and this is present Robert putting a block for future Robert so that future Robert's mind is blown. that is all the things I'm doing now to help out future Robert hear something amazing and not be spoiled, because that already sounds awesome. And you've only told me what it is, and you've even told me what track it is, and I don't want you to tell me, because I want to keep that a mystery. But that's kind of awesome.
Either way, I'm proud of it, and that one actually kind of came to a completion just like a month or two ago. So that was also kind of a, you know, I'm finishing my Kickstarter, but at the same time, crap, I got to finish this track.
Yeah. So,
it's been interesting, but yeah, there's a lot coming out, so keep an eye out. Thanks again for having me. And you got 2 weeks left to get your pledge in. So let's make this thing happen.
Yeah, totally. Of course, you can find me. I'm at Vincent404 there on the Twitters and the Facebook and everything else. If you want to catch previous episodes of this podcast, you can head to our website, cosmicradiotv.com/8bitlife. You have links to show notes, our Twitter account for the show, which is at 8bitlifepodcast, and other shows in the network. And of course, after you've kicked all the funds you can to the American Pixels, after you've helped that album become reality, and you look in your pockets and you say, you know, I got a quarter still left, head over to patreon.com/8bitlife. You can help this show become bigger, better, and more awesome. That's it for today. Tune next time we talk another game. I'll see you completely and utterly random. Bye, people.
This has been a CosmicRadio.tv audio production. For more awesome shows, head on over to our website, CosmicRadio.tv.